Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
There are a couple of articles that caught my eye lately. They were in the financial sector, and so I thought I'd ask Bob Westrick to come in. You've met Bob before on this radio show. He is a partner with Private Vista. They are wealth managers in Chicago. That means planning and investing in Chicago and the suburbs. Bob's been sort of a financial go-to guy for us a lot of times, and we invited him back in the studio. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Doing well, John. Thank you.
Isn't it a coincidence that every time you come on, it seems, somebody's just won the lottery, and there's big lottery news. That guy in Wisconsin who won, what was it, Elif, like $740 million? $704 million was going into Target stores with gift cards, $200 gift cards, just because he used to work at a Target. And he was just coming up to people going, here, here's $200. You know what most people did?
Said thank you?
They said no thank you. They said they thought it was some sort of scam. They were skeptical of him coming up.
Wow.
Which I sort of understand, right? Because nobody does that. But this guy was doing it, and there's a story in the Tribune today about one woman who said thank you and took the $200. I think she was buying diapers or something, and that's what I would do. I would love to win the lottery and then be that guy. I would probably get mugged a lot. But he took his 700 and some million dollars as a one lump sum, which I always advise against. I think you should take it as a 20-year annuity. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I don't think you should be giving financial advice, John, to a lot of winners.
Right.
That aside, typically when you run the numbers, it's definitely in your to your advantage to take a lump sum, because they discount that lump sum at such a low interest rate typically that while it's great for discipline reasons, you know, you're not going to run out of money, and that's great, John, for
you.
A lot of people.
Thank you.
That's a wonderful thing for a lot of people, because a lot of folks who win, let's say, $1 million, $2, $3 million, they blow it all. They're like, I'm rich. I can buy anything. And they buy a couple houses, a car, whatever, and all of a sudden they have no money. And to your point, they would have been a lot better off just taking the annuity.
So, right. So what would you advise me to do? What would you advise a guy to do?
Well, it depends who the guy is. I mean, if it's somebody who's somewhat sophisticated, and as a financial advisor, then I would absolutely say take the lump sum. If it was me, I would absolutely, hands down, take the lump sum.
Yeah.
But for a lot of folks who win, let's say, $1 million, $2, $3 million, who might have just been, not real disciplined with their spending or savings, then they should definitely take the annuity.
Or never had that kind of money. I mean, it's like suddenly you've got to speak in a foreign language. You just don't know what this is like. And here's the advantage to the person who takes it over 20 years. When someone comes up and goes, hey, we're going to open up a sushi joint in Lamont, what do you say? You can say, you know what, I'm tapped out. Check with me in another year. Check with me in a few more years, because I didn't get it all. I only got a couple $1 million right now. So over 20 years, it sort of, I think, wards off would-be suitors of your money, because you don't have it right now. You
True.
Couldn't blow it if you wanted.
True. Of course, that guy from Wisconsin would be getting about $30-40 million a year and probably could help you with that piece of place. But
no, it's a sushi place in Lamont.
He could help you with both.
So there's a story in the paper. It says that it was written by a woman in St. Louis. Vittert was her last name, right? And she said that if you are thinking about buying a house, you're probably better off renting. Liberty Vittert is her name. And this was on FoxNews.com, a statistician's new take on the old question about renting or buying. She says, from the time we're little kids, we're told by our caring parents, save up so you can buy that house. And a lot of us have done that. I don't think that equation has changed. You have equity. You get a tax deduction. You have a place maybe to live someday, or at least it's a good place to park money. As it gets more valuable, your asset grows. And then when you sell it, you're able to cash in. I can't think of any reason to rent. And then she goes through this whole article and pops every bubble about that. Without reading the whole article on the air, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I read the article. Some of her assumptions that she makes are very, very valid, and some of her conclusions are valid, too. However, you know what? Like any other sort of rule of thumb, if you're thinking about buying versus selling, or renting versus buying, you really have to look at your own situation. You know, how much would the place that you're going to buy be versus the place that you're going to rent? Also, how long do you think you're going to be in that place? If it's going to be like 1 to 3 years, you should probably just rent, because there's been a lot of transaction costs in the buying and selling that would be hard to overcome. But in over 7, 8 years, you're probably going to be better owning. You know, but in that maybe, you know, 4 to 6 year period, you just have to decide whether it's worth to you to take a little bit of risk on the on your house appreciation or depreciation, you know, versus renting.
Well, and what are you going to do with the money that you're saving? If the rent is $500, but the mortgage is $1,000, either way, if you're going to rent and in theory save $500, then presumably you're going to do something with that other $500. You're going
right.
to invest it.
Right.
And she said that probably you'll do just as well in the market, maybe better, with your extra money than putting it into a mortgage.
Yeah, she didn't really say that. She had said that with that extra money you invested over 30 years, you know, at 5%, you'd have about $250,000. Okay, and the house that you bought, the hypothetical house, was $200,000, and it only takes 0.75% annual appreciation to get to that $250,000 equivalent. And if you just have a 2% annualized appreciation of that same $200,000 house, then you're over $485,000 versus that $250,000. So, yeah, you're taking some risk on the appreciation of the house, but you're also taking, in the other case, you know, some risk on the appreciation of the stock market.
In the market or bonds or whatever you put the money in, right?
Right. And the other thing, John, understand that in a lot of things in theory work great and in practice don't. For instance, I'm going to take that extra money I'm not paying on my housing and I'm going to put it into a good mutual fund or something. Okay? In theory, great. In practice, I've got more money. I'm going to take a trip to Greece. I'm going to buy a nicer car. I'm going to eat at nicer restaurants. That's kind of what a lot of people do that I know. So if you truly had the discipline, maybe it would be a closer race, but a lot of people don't.
She also cites a bunch of things that we just don't think about when we buy a house outside of the mortgage, insurance, and taxes. She says, what about extra fees associated with the initial purchase, which are 4% sometimes of the purchase price? Annual maintenance, she says, is 1.5%. I think she's just making these numbers up, but let's let her have it.
Sure.
Renovation, 1%. Homeowner's insurance, 1%. Property taxes, 1%. Dreaded, unexpected, but inevitable, unforeseen costs. Yeah, there's expenses when you own a home. I guess we all know that. Some of us address those more deliberately than others. But is that enough to keep you from buying a house? I would hope not. I'm just old school about this.
And frankly, John, I don't really know anyone yet, and I'm not saying some people haven't, actually done a cost benefit between renting and buying. I mean, folks generally, they're buying a home because they want stability. They want it to form community. They want to be there for a while. They want to be able to paint a wall and not have to call the landlord. They want to be sure that they can live in the same house that maybe their kids are in. And after 3 years, the landlord doesn't say, you know what, I sold your house to somebody else. You got to get out. You know, so there's a lot of other reasons that are non-financial to make that decision of renting versus buying.
Well, I'm glad you said that because really, I mean, it's your money. You get to do whatever you want with it. And if doing this makes you happy, isn't that the end game? Isn't that the object of the game? I have a friend I know who has never been that deliberate about his career as some of us have. And as a result, he hasn't had as much money. And as a result, his house hasn't always been repaired the way maybe he'd wanted. And he also seems to have more free time. And he seems to be enjoying life a lot more than those of us who are running as fast as we can on the treadmill. I've looked at him sometimes and I thought, maybe I've got it wrong. You know, he seems to be enjoying his life. That's a lot to just say what you said about renting versus buying. If the house makes you happier, then maybe that's almost reason enough to be a home buyer versus a home renter.
Certainly. I mean, when we, I don't know about you, John, but when we bought our house, I mean, we never even thought about, what would be financially optimal, renting versus buying. We wanted to find a spot that we were comfortable with, it felt safe, it had good schools, good community, good churches, you know, good restaurants, of course, you know, and a place where our children could feel like this is home. So
there's also a story at MotleyFool.com, and I saw another story like this week, and that was $1 million may not be enough. That's the golden number, I think, for people. Would you agree with me on that, Bob? if I have $1 million, I'll be able to retire someday.
Well, I think that maybe a lot of people think that, but I mean, believe me, we've got 1,000 clients, and you know, $1 million for one is vastly not enough, and $1 million for others is plenty.
Most people don't have $1 million in retirement funds.
That's true.
Not even close to that. And the number of people who have pensions that are going to make up some sort of difference is a lot less than it used to be as well. So just talk to me about how I'm going to come up with a number, if you even like that concept, in a minute. It's 2:20. We're talking to Bob Westrick. He is a partner at Private Vista. Bob Westrick is a partner at Private Vista. We're talking about things financial, by the way, with Bob. And there's a couple articles in the news lately. I wanted Bob's views on it. So there we are. $1 million, Bob.
Yes.
The golden number that a lot of people, I think, aspire to when they retire someday. And then here's the Motley Fool saying the $1 million myth, why $1 million may not be enough in retirement. I don't see how it's not. If you have $1 million and then you say, okay, I'll just put that somewhere and get 4% interest, then I'll get $40,000 a year. And then every year I'll have $40,000. That with Social Security or pension or whatever else you'll cobble together, you're at $50,000. That's the average income for an American. Household income's around $50K. So then you're good to go for life. And you don't even touch the principal. Your thoughts?
First of all, another very, very gross rule of thumb, $1 million. Everybody spends differently. You know, for some folks, that's more than enough money. And for some folks, that's not nearly enough for their lifestyle. But to your point, you know, there's that old 4% rule. It's a rule that's been around since 1994. There was a study done, and apparently, you know, you can take, let's say you have $1 million, in your very first year of retirement, you take out 4%. You take out $40,000. And then every year you increase that distribution, that withdrawal by inflation, so that your actually buying power never goes down. So in year two, there's been 2% inflation. Now you take out $40,800.
Right.
And so you should be able to buy the same amount of goods and services as before. Last year, the average amount of Social Security, and once again, this is an average, by couples in the United States was $28,000, roughly. Okay, so you go 40,000, 28, you're at $68,000. So bottom line is some people live very, very comfortably on $68,000 and some people don't. So when you ask, you know, is $1 million enough? It's enough for some and not enough for others. So as you know, you have to do the financial planning. You have to find out just really, you know, for me to live an enriched and fulfilling retirement, how much money do I want to spend? And then back into the number.
What about my idea, though, that you don't touch the principal? You just live off the interest.
Well, first of all, this whole interest thing we've talked about many times. And
why do you get mad at me when I say that?
Because I keep telling you why not to say it, yet you persist.
Well, you do put it in a thing that generates interest, right?
Well, what you do is you invest it, John. And the 4% rule is you just take 4% of the total return.
Okay.
Interest and dividends are just two of the three components of total appreciation.
I thought the 4% rule was that you would get 4%.
No.
Why not?
No. Well, there's no 4%, you know, guarantee really that you can get. And let's say you do get 4%, John. So now you get, your $40,000 just the way John Williams wants to do it. And now 10 years from now, you're still getting $40,000. But, you know, the gallon of gas that you were paying for, now instead of costing $4, costs $5.
Yeah.
Okay, and everything costs more. So bottom line is every year you can afford less and less and less and less.
And I'm saying $1 million only because I think that's a ballpark that everybody wants to achieve. Some people have, most people won't, and
Sure. Certainly
right now don't. But I guess this same conversation applies to people who have $100,000 in savings for retirement.
Right.
Whatever the amount is.
Right. And the thing is, John, is once again, you have to calculate what that number is in order to generate enough income for you to live the life that you want to live. Okay. But the bottom line is, if you don't want that 100,000 or million or 10 million to run out, okay, just the first rule of thumb, and if you're investing in roughly a portfolio of 60% stocks and 40% bonds, is that you probably don't want to take out more than 4% initially, and then every year thereafter, more than that amount plus inflation.
So however much money you're able to save,
mm-hmm.
just imagine that the most you're ever going to pull out is 4%. Is that the rule of thumb we're at least talking about here?
4% in the very first year, and then you increase
inflation.
It by inflation.
Yeah,
right.
Okay, I'm out of time, Ellis said. which is a shame because I thought I was on a roll there, Bob, with that interest thing. I thought I was really making some ground there.
Yeah, you're actually backtracking a little bit, but I like what you're thinking.
Yeah. All right. So the company is called Private Vista. The website is myprivatevista.com. I appreciate you coming in, Bob.
Thank you,
John. Next time I have some, if nothing else, you dissuade me of some of my harebrained financial ideas from the lottery on down. So I appreciate you coming in for that.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Bob Westrick.